Radio City, time for another broadcast or podcast, if you will, and even if you won't. John Grayson, Rob Ross, going over the world as it appears to us. And Rob, over these last 7 days, there has been plenty that has appeared to us. What's going on in New York?
This shithole?
Yeah, well, you know, I had to call all of my relatives from the shithole countries that brought me here. So, you know, I figured it was time to go revisit that. What a fucking stupid thing. I mean, of all the things that we've heard come out of his mouth. And here's something odd about that. And for people who may have forgotten what we're talking about or didn't know, Donald Trump, in front of a bunch of senators, Democrats and Republicans, where he should have known better, referred to African countries and Haiti and a couple of countries in Central America as shithole countries. And this is, we are now on day three of this, because we're talking on a Sunday night. That broke on Friday afternoon. Actually, no, that's not true. We're on day four because it broke on Thursday night, and it was all the talk on Friday morning. So this now has been one of the longest lasting Trump fuck-ups that I can remember. Usually by now he's done something else, and he tried to take the onus and take some of the attention away from this thing, but it's living on because people in other countries are now righteously indignant.
Well, you know, there are a couple of things to say about this. One, his attempt at diffusing it and obfuscating what he'd said in part today was him signing an official bill making Martin Luther King Day a national holiday.
Right.
Now, I will grant you, I don't have tomorrow off, but isn't it already a national holiday?
Yeah, I thought so. And I'm the same as you. I don't have tomorrow off either.
But that's number one. Number two is, while it was a dick move on the president's part, you can't argue with the fact that a lot of countries are shitholes. But then again, hey, you know what? We're turning into a shithole.
Right.
The way people have allowed themselves to act and be systematically drawn into these tribes,
right,
as you and I are so tired of at this stage, you know, there are countries in Europe that have gone from being quite civilized to turning into shitholes before our eyes because of the influx of people they've allowed in. While it was a stupid thing for him to say, you know, he was calling a spade, the problem is you're the president of the United States. You and I can say, this is a shithole, that's a shithole. Look, I can go to different sections of Staten Island and say, ugh, what a shithole.
Right,
you know?
Right.
I can go to Brooklyn and look at it and go, I was born in this shithole.
What really, I think, got him in trouble on this, though, is not so much that even that comment, because you're right. I mean, that's just it's a matter of opinion, and it's something that can be debated about different places around the world. But the fact that he was talking about the people who come from those countries, why do we have to let in people who come from these shithole countries, as though it's somehow a reflection on them? Meanwhile, the white guys from Norway are on Donald Trump's preferred list. Well, you know, that's where it starts to become. I mean, the country itself wasn't really the target of his remarks. It was human beings who, by accident of birth, happen to be from Haiti or Chad or Sudan or someplace like that.
Right. It's more of a case of, why are those people coming from those countries? Because those countries are shitholes. That's why they're coming from them. They're leaving them.
Right.
Because they want to get out of the shithole. You know, these are countries with fucked up governments.
Right. And meanwhile, the people in Norway are going, we wouldn't leave here to go there. What the hell's the matter with you? Why would I leave here?
Well, the Vikings themselves have their own problems, and we're not talking about Minnesota because they've got no problems now.
That's right. Yeah, what a game. We'll get to that later. But yeah, it was another stupid comment, but this one may actually follow him for a while.
Oh, I will bet on it. And of course, at the same time, I'm sure he and his advisors are rather nervous at the fact that it seems every time we turn around, yet another Republican senator is either going to resign or not run for re-election in these midterms,
yeah,
which means – and I'm not jumping the gun here by any stretch, that the Democrats could conceivably pick up the Senate in the midterms. However, knowing the current crop of what's calling themselves the Democrats, I'm sure they're going to fuck themselves up royally because they're so good at collectively shitting the bed, because they're as much a bunch of assholes as the Republicans are.
Right.
So they're going to probably trot out the dumbest fucks that they can find, people of the Bernie Sanders ilk or Bernie Light. Meanwhile, the press, who's doing a wonderful job of turning this whole thing about Trump saying shithole around and making it a racist comment, which in a lot of ways it really is not. It's a half-baked observation by a dumb human being. They are completely neglecting the fact that there is finally an investigation underway to Jane Sanders bankrupting Burlington College.
Yes.
You know, is this finally the proverbial smoking gun that every rational human being has been waiting so that way they bury this old fossil and that hag wife of his?
Yeah, and it might be. I think that, you know, again, you take their ilk and you look at what could happen in the midterms. And if the Democrats are going to find a way to step on their own dick, it's going to be by doing that. But as far as those two are concerned, right now, outside of the state of Vermont, there's no political future for Bernie Sanders anyway. I mean, the guy's
God's ears. That's all I have to say.
Well, he's what, 1,000? So, I mean, how much gas is really going to be left in that tank? And the fact
he's
is,
full of gas anyway. Because it's sorry to cut you off, but that fucking gas bag is always out there shooting off his yak. You know, every time, you know, there's no difference between he and Donald Trump. They're both completely full of shit
and completely self-absorbed. Right.
Exactly. Except yeah. Donald Trump actually won the presidency.
Well, you know, you don't have to worry about it, though, Rob, because Oprah's out there.
Oh, I'll let you go first.
Yeah. Okay, let's start here. All of a sudden, Oprah gives a decent speech, and it was. I mean, even just from a purely empirical standpoint, it was a good speech. It was a rousing speech. She hit the notes she had to hit, and it went off to that audience, and she was, of course, playing to the crowd inside as well as the crowd outside, but the crowd inside was exactly the audience to hear what she was saying. So they ate it up. So it looked like a world-beating speech. Well, to begin with, even if it wasn't Oprah Winfrey, I am sick of a good speech means you can be president. No, it doesn't. A good speech means he gave a good speech. Now, on to Oprah Winfrey. This idea that somehow because you're successful in one area, you can be a good president is also something incredibly stupid, because Donald Trump was very successful, not only in one area, but in two, as a real estate developer and as a reality show TV star. He was very successful in those things. You can't take that away from him. He is a joke, a miserable, pathetic joke as a president. So, no, you can't translate one to the other. And as far as Oprah Winfrey's credentials are concerned, this is the woman who gave us Dr. Phil. This is the woman who gave us James Fry. And if a dumb redneck like James Fry is smarter than Oprah Winfrey to the point that he can put one over on her, she is disqualified from becoming the president of the United States. How is she going to deal with Vladimir Putin when she can't figure out James Fry?
Is that my cue?
Yeah, that is your cue.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's also talk about the photos of her making all huggy and kissy with Donald J. Trump.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
You know. Donald Trump was a game show host. Because that's what The Apprentice was. It was a game show.
Right.
Oprah Winfrey is a talk show host. She's even less on the food chain. Because she was just relegated to afternoons. And all she does is pander. And that's what that speech was. As, you know, good as it was, and I'm using good in the quotation marks, she was pandering to an already fever pitch audience filled with panderers.
Right.
These are people who, and this is why everyone needs to regain perspective and take a step back and look at the entire picture. These are people who are wealthier than any of us will ever possibly be. These are people who are actors. They are paid handsomely to entertain. These people are, I would say, 75% truly uneducated. They didn't bother to go to college and do the normal things that any of us have done in our lives. We are learned people. You know, John is a surgeon. You know, I am a lawyer. And therefore, I'm lying, but
right.
I'm planning on running for president anyway, so you might as well start buying it, you know. The point is, without too much of the comedy, because I really don't want to go off topic, is that that audience could not have been more full of shit. This was one of the most transparent things I think I've ever seen. That's what made me so furious about it. Oprah Winfrey was the icing on an already very rancid cake.
Yep.
Because it started with the whole, hashtag Me Too. And what's the other hashtag buzz phrase?
Now it's time's up.
Time's up. Yeah. And wearing black. Did you see half of the way those women were dressed in black? Half of a dress was on most of them.
Yeah, right. You know,
showing off tits and ass left, right, and center. Somehow, I think there is a very thwarted, very misguided, and completely self-absorbed sense of all of this. I don't think there was anything even remotely altruistic. What I think this was yet again a collective circle jerk.
Yep.
Everybody patting themselves on the back saying, look at how wonderful we are. These are actors. And people need to remember, actors are even lower on the food chain than musicians are.
Not to mention the fact they get paid to lie. They get paid to put forth an image that is not real.
And let's face it, they're actors.
Right.
Actors are going to act before the camera and pretend to be morally indignant and outraged and decry this, that, and the other imagined, supposed, alleged crimes against humanity of the week. That's how these people operate. You know, you're talking about people who are quote-unquote, and I'm using these terms loosely because as you had very saliently brought up in the last conversation, Harvey Weinstein is not a, quote, powerful man. He was just a guy running a studio. So he had all the money and all the cards and the connections.
Right.
There's no such true thing as power when it comes to entertainment. Okay? Let us make that very clear distinction. The only power that there really is heads of nations, for good, bad, or indifferent. These so-called powerful actors and actresses, and this includes people like Salma Hayek and Angelina Jolie and Ashley Judd, these are all women who have made fantastic fortunes and yet didn't see fit to say anything that they were so enraged by until now, when the entire tidal wave has moved in that direction. They too have cast their surfboards along with the wave. Right there, you have to understand they're full of shit, because if it was something that was genuinely serious, meaningful, and needed to be addressed when it was happening, it was certainly around the time that Salma Hayek was going on about making the movie Frida.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. And it gives that impression that, it wasn't, like you said, it wasn't that big of a deal at the time, or at least not big enough a deal. And the fact of the matter is, as we saw with Harvey Weinstein, and as we're seeing now with James Franco and whoever else is next on the list, and Kevin Spacey, whatever quote-unquote power they were supposed to have deflated in an instant. It was gone. They were out. So that could have happened at any step along the way. All it took was for somebody to stand up and say, hey, that guy tried to fuck me and told me I wouldn't get the part unless I did. Boom. Over with. But no, nobody did.
Right. Right. And by the way, just, you know, the latest is Aziz Ansari has been, you know, accused of sexual misconduct. Now, there is nothing really detailed about it. This was breaking before you and I went on the air. But there you go. Now, the interesting thing is I've noticed for all of the screaming and accusations that are being thrown about left, right, and center, have you noticed that the political stripes of nearly everyone that has been accused of sexual harassment are all liberals and or Democrats?
It hadn't really occurred to me, but yeah, you're right. And they were the ones that were keeping the system afloat.
Yeah. So riddle me this, Batman. Why the fuck are we spending our hard-earned money on these less than mediocre performances in these really shitty movies to keep these people in business. We should nationally boycott films, unless you have movie pass and then you don't have to worry about it because you pay $10 for the month and you can go see anything you want without having to pay for it every damn time. I refuse to see any motion pictures right now. I will not go to the theater.
Here's what else bothers me about this, and it goes back to something Paul Sorvino said. He made some statements afterward about how Harvey Weinstein ruined his daughter's career, which he may very well have done, because the way the story goes, Harvey Weinstein approached Mira Sorvino, gave her the speech about how you do what I want you to do or I will ruin you. And she said, no, go stick it up your ass. And he ruined her. He, you know, he blackballed her from the business. But here's what I don't understand about that. And I can understand Paul Sorvino, by the way, being royally pissed off about that and saying, I'll knock his teeth down his throat. That's fine, too. What I don't get is Mira Sorvino hasn't worked in a very long time. It's been a decade or so. So where has she been for those 10 years? I mean, she had nothing to lose. She was already out.
There's something else to be taken into account, too. Who was Mira Sorvino's boyfriend at the time?
I don't know.
Quentin Tarantino.
Oh, okay, right.
I don't think we have to say anything more than that. I think all of it speaks for itself.
Because everybody agreed to let the system stay like it was. Everybody agreed.
So people really need to get their collective heads out of their asses yet again and look at the overall big picture.
Yeah.
This is the time for big picture viewing and thinking, you know, because the way that the press has been spinning everything for the last few years, there's a very clear-cut case of tunnel vision here. You only are allowed to see what they want you to see because they don't want you to see the entire story. This is not some kind of conspiracy theory thing. You know, this is reality. You know, it's – you have to ask the – a real reporter asks the questions.
Yeah.
Okay, if A happened, why didn't B happen in the immediate aftermath?
Right.
Which is possibly the simplest question of all to ask. No one's sought to done that.
Yeah. And I don't get why. And yet, again, maybe it's just that perpetuation, that idea that, well, we want change, but we don't want too much change. And I think that's cowardly and stupid. But then again, so are most things. Now,
especially actors.
Right.
And right now, the current crop that's out there are possibly the most talentless that I've ever seen. You know, you go back and you can watch an old film and you see that the people actually learned their craft, you know? But you see these dimwits who are considered, you know, the creme de la creme right now, and God, they're just so banal and completely void of true personality. That's why every time I see anybody being interviewed, I kind of cringe and then I make sure I turn the sound down so I'm not disturbed by them.
Right. Yeah, and you're right. Even when they try to remake something, I don't get the idea of remakes when the original source material still stands up. And Hollywood is so completely out of ideas that they're doing that. They're going back and remaking movies that are still – you go back and watch the original, it's still a great movie. Some things don't wear well, and you need to kind of update them after a while, and I get that. But – some things are just fine. Leave them alone. And invariably now, the remakes that they do not hold a candle to the original piece of work.
They certainly know how to manipulate the stories also so that they kind of force a message that the original didn't really, you know, have or intend to have.
Right.
Speaking of messages, I haven't seen The Last Jedi yet. But I've read some very off-putting things about it, and I think the most off-putting thing, which is why now I'm beginning to consider not going and just waiting until it's on pay-per-view. I don't want to use the word hidden because it's not so hidden because it was picked up on by many writers.
Yeah.
But there's a politically correct agenda yet again shoved into the making of this movie that after reading about it, I was very put off by. I'm not going to go into the details of it. Just look it up. You know, find out for yourselves. If you haven't seen it yet and you've been on the fence, you may decide like me, okay, you know, maybe it's not worth my money. Let me pay $6.99 rather than paying like $30+ for two movie tickets.
Right. Yeah. I'm curious to find out what that is because I haven't seen that bit yet. And when I walked out of the movie, I didn't feel like I had been beaten over the head with a political agenda the way that a lot of people did. I didn't even bother with Avatar. I still, to this day, have not seen Avatar because I just don't need it. I just don't.
Was that the one who made Titanic?
Yeah, with the blue people flying around and shit.
All I can tell you is this. I had to sit through Titanic because the wretch that I was dating at the time dragged me to go see it.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it was a chick flick. And apart from seeing Kate Winslet's, you know, delightful tits, all I remember was having a really sore ass from sitting for 3 hours.
Yeah.
But that was also the torture weeks of the Christmas holidays in which she also dragged me to see Evita. No comment. You know, I got my revenge. I made her go see Beavis and Butthead Do America.
There you
because
go.
I'm a guy.
Probably. Yeah,
and it's dick balls.
And it's a much better movie than either of the other two you mentioned. So,
let me put it to you this way, just to give you a hint. Intimations made about Princess Leia, which I found beyond insulting.
Okay.
Go into this one, but look it up. You'll find it, and you'll scratch your head and go, what the fuck could they have been thinking?
Now, before we leave the news entirely, because we do want to get into our little record label discussion that erupted online, because, well, you know, something popped into my head, as is so often the case. That's why we do the In Our Heads segment, by the way, at the end of these things, is because both of us suffer from this. Every so often, something just pops in there and you go, hey. So the record label thing started off that way, and we'll get to that in a minute. But the other thing that's been going on, and I wouldn't mention it except for the fact that it has now made national and international news, as Missouri state politics has now gone crazy with the governor, Eric Greitens of the state of Missouri, being investigated for physical assault and the possible sexual blackmail of a woman that he was sleeping with. Who was also married, by the way, and so is he. And this story has just, it's gotten completely insane. And over the last couple of days, the latest allegation is that while they were sleeping together, for, you know, just to go through this as quickly as we can, the deal is this hairdresser, who was Eric Greitens' hairdresser, had a crush on him, and he apparently on her. So the two of them flirted and flirted, and finally he said, you need to come over to my house. She did. That's when she says, when things started to get sexual, he tied her up, blindfolded her, and took pictures of her, and at that point told her, if you ever mention my name or tell anybody that this happened, I will ruin you. So that's the sexual blackmail part. A couple of days later, her lawyer comes out and says, well, yeah, but a little while after that, during a period of reconciliation, that with this, when this woman went back to her husband, who, by the way, is a kind of an open secret around these parts who this guy is, because he's got a degree of fame as well, that when she went back to him and tried to reconcile, Greitens asked her, have you been sleeping with anybody else while you've been seeing me? And she said, yeah, I slept with my husband and he hit her. So things are not going well. Now, the governor denies all of this except for the fact that he slept with her. He admitted to the affair, but he denies everything else. And so now this is the state of, pardon the pun, but the state of affairs in Missouri, watching all of this crap go down and realizing again that, you know, there is a more than distinct possibility that Eric Greitens is going to survive this and will continue attempting to make his run for the presidency, where I think if Donald Trump had not been elected, this story would have ruined him by now.
Show me.
Right. Thank you.
Okay. A couple of things. One, what I forgive my ignorance. I've seen bits and pieces of the story through your postings and just fleetingly.
Yeah.
What party is he in? Is he a Republican?
Oh, he's a Republican. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Interestingly enough, it hasn't picked up any traction yet in New York.
That is funny because, yeah, the French and the Brits are all over this story.
Well, the French and the Brits are like that. They're all over everything.
Yeah.
You know, with the French, you know, they'll be with a woman and they'll be kissing her hand and her arm and her neck and, you know, whispering sweet nothings. By that point, the Brits are already married with two kids, you know. Those people are about as subtle as flying mallets, for Christ's sakes.
Right. So, yeah, it's a weird one, but it is one to look up. And I mean, the salacious details on this thing, if anything ruins him, it's going to be if there is proof of the sexual blackmail, which right now seems to be a he said, she said thing.
In New York, and see, that's why it's funny. I've gotten bits and pieces of the story. In New York, there's a fellow in politics named Klein. I think he's a senator.
Okay.
So forgive me. I know of him because he's the very longtime boyfriend of my local senator, Diane Savino, mm-hmm. who I am a very huge fan and supporter of. By the way, she is a Democrat, but she actually does her job.
Wow, novel.
Well, at the same time, we have a Republican borough president, James Otto, who does his job.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Senator Savino's boyfriend, Mr. Klein, has been accused of sexual harassment. Part of the allegation, and here's where it's murky, and that's the way I'll put it, is that he propositioned some woman at a party, blah, 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 blah. Short story is, people were at this party and said, this never happened. Yeah. So now we're going back into the realm of credibility, honesty. You know, if somebody looks at you funny, are you going to start accusing them of sexual harassment and destroying their lives?
Right.
For some people who are sick enough to do that, there are a lot of self-absorbed people out there. I would say about 90% of our population is like that.
Well, and there are also people who get pissed off enough to do it, who don't like somebody or they have a personal conflict and they go, you know, I know an easy way to ruin this cat, and don't have the shame to go along with it, to say, no, you know, that's really not the right thing to do. And we'll go ahead and haul off and make the accusation against somebody just to see him flounder.
Because people love to buy into these cliches and ideas that they're so willing to accept that they'll be pounded into their heads, like, you know, sisters and, you know, powerful women. And
me too.
Strong women. Enough.
Yeah. Okay? By the way, on that subject, tell me that the people in New York are not buying into this rehabilitation of Michael Grimm.
How about them Vikings?
Really? They're buying it from that son of a bitch?
Do you know why? Because they hate Dan Donovan.
Okay.
Even though Donovan is a Republican, you know, and Donovan voted against Trump's tax plan. He was one of the senators who – a congressman, sorry, who actually voted against it. But there are people who are so stupid and willing to buy anything someone like Grimm says. Yeah, he still has a following. I don't believe – he will ever be reelected.
Good.
But he had already been indicted when he won reelection last time.
Yeah.
So I'm fazed by nothing.
I love the fact that he's still on this kick of saying, well, it was a civil matter. No, dickhead, you went to prison. It was a criminal matter. It was not a civil matter. And, you know, and he's just following again. He's following the leader because what's Donald Trump's raison d'etre in all of this? Well, when you get caught doing something really sleazy, lie your ass off.
Or spin it so that way, well, hang on. You've just accused me of something, but here's the dirt that we have on you.
Right. It's pathetic.
Crooked Hillary.
Right. Yeah, and he's still, for some reason, battling not only her but Barack Obama. Neither one of them is going to be president or be president again. So, yeah, in the midst of all of that, so this record label thing started out.
Because we're actually going to take you back into being entertained.
Yes, right.
I realize that what we're doing here is very entertaining as far as politics, basically because we are pissing on the fire known as our current governmental system, but also the fact that, I hate the fact that we have to explain the fact that all of what we're saying is in a very comedic fashion, but the serious undertone of all this is the fact that people have gotten so stupidly out of control that we're just trying to point out that look at everything from both sides and then take a deep breath before you have that knee-jerk reaction or you push a button or you say something you're going to regret or do something you will really regret.
Exactly.
Right. We have no regrets about what we say because we're professionals. You know?
Yeah, such as we are. And so the record label thing, it all started out because something popped into my head, and I don't even remember which label it was, but you are, in terms of your knowledge of the history of it, you know more about record labels than anybody else I know. And I'm a liner notes reader. I'm a label geek to a degree, but I don't have half the knowledge on all of it that you do. So this thing was rolling through my head, and I remember what it was. I heard a song on the radio, and when I heard the song come on, I saw the label on the 45 spinning around in my head.
Now you got to tell me.
It was cover of Rolling Stone.
And at the time, I believe, I might be wrong, but I believe, wasn't Dr. Hook on Columbia?
Yes.
Okay. Because I remember they did a stint on, God help us, Capitol and Casablanca.
Right. And the Columbia label that one was on particularly was the one with the Pac-Man C.
The orange fade into red.
Grading into red, exactly. So I saw that in my head and I thought, how cool that after all this time, I still have that. And I started going through them all, RKO and, Atlantic and Bang. And you know, there were labels that only ever appeared on 45s, and there were labels that were mostly album labels. And I thought, what's the indispensable one for me? Because, I mean, without IRS, I would lose a good portion of the REM catalog and so many other great pieces of music. But, you know, I've got to go back to the old Atlantic label, which gave us a little, not only the early Led Zeppelin stuff, but also Buffalo Springfield. And I mean,
careful. Remember who you're talking to now. What's my alma mater?
Right. But, you know, I don't, it's so hard to discern, you know, even a label that was among the sort of also-rans at the time, Chrysalis, gave us things like Huey Lewis and the News' sports album and things like that. And I mean, I could live without it, but it's a kind of indelible piece of the 80s. And without that, a good piece of the movie American Psycho doesn't exist. So,
I mean, hey, work your way backwards with the Chrysalis thing. Before Huey Lewis and the News, the big Chrysalis act was Spandau Ballet. And before that was Blondie.
Right.
At Generation X and Billy Idol's solo career. And before that, you had, of course, Jethro Tull, whose management company started Chrysalis.
Yeah.
And you had the different Chrysalis labels, the original green one and then the famous blue one. Or at the tail end of the lifespan of Chrysalis Records, Robbie Williams.
Yeah, and so that's the point, is that, you know, all of these things are indispensable in one way or another. And I just, you know, put up, okay, what's your one indispensable, absolutely indispensable record label? And the thing just exploded. I didn't realize there were that many people who paid that much attention to it like we do.
Oh, well, that made me feel so good. That made me so happy. I mean, the fact that you brought up Bang Records, I'm hoping that you're referring to Bang because Neil Diamond was the mainstay of the original Bang label.
Yep.
I mean, Van Morrison did one album, Van Morrison Blows Your Minds. The McCoys did Hang on Sloopy for Bang. And, of course, the first Bang single was I Want Candy by the Strangeloves. But, yeah, the original Bang – well, most people don't even realize Bang Records went through Atlantic Records, actually.
Yep.
And I didn't find that out until I started working for Atlantic Records because, you know, we had the catalog right there in our database of, you know, because of paying royalties. And there's The Feel of Neil Diamond, which was an album that I didn't even know existed, which is embarrassing for me.
Mm-hmm. But,
you know, those incredible singles that he'd done, Solitary Man, Shiloh, especially Shiloh. I could do a whole show about Shiloh on its own. Kentucky Woman, Cherry, Thank the Lord for the Nighttime. I mean, I think he was at his best, and he peaked when he wrote Shiloh and put out the original version on Bang. When he went to Uni, he just became – there's another label, Uni,
yep,
which was part of the MCA music division along with CAP, K-A-P-P, and Decca, which was the home, of course, of The Who.
Right.
And then they were all folded into what became the brand new MCA Records label in the United States as of January 1, 1973, starting the first MCA single released, official MCA single released, was Crocodile Rock. They hadn't even had the famous Rainbow label yet. It was just a black label.
Yeah.
However, over in Europe, all those labels were already known as MCA because they couldn't use the name of Decca because that was a completely different company in Europe, and Uni and Captain really exist over there, so they were called MCA. But it was done more with the American Decca logo. You know, if you remember the old bar that had these little colored markings,
sure,
for the Decca label, it just said MCA instead, but it had the Decca Harlequin and the little colored bars. Okay, so you brought up Bang, and that made me happy. You brought up Virgin. Virgin's also a very important label. I mean, you had XTC. It's my immediate connection to Virgin. Not even the Sex Pistols thing. It's XTC was Virgin.
Yeah.
You have on your list Apple.
Of course.
The ripoff of Banana Records, part of Ruddlecore. of course, for me, the indelible labels... And Atlantic Records, well, I mean, I worked for Atlantic Records, so that's the apex of anything, because to me, Atlantic Records was the gold standard. But for one, Stax Records.
Yeah, and now, Stax is also on my list. Love them.
Yes, it is. But there are the three labels. Now, the question is, which of the three, when somebody says to you Stax, which one immediately comes into your head?
Wow. Well, I had so many different singles that were on Stax, so it's hard to pick one. I'm trying to remember the first one that I saw.
Technically, there's four different labels, and I'll get to that little delineation in a moment. Because the first one is the original blue one.
The blue one, right? And that's probably to me what I see.
Table. Right. That's the Atlantic Records period.
Okay.
That's the golden era of Stax. When everything that came out on that label basically hit the top of the charts, whether it was Otis Redding, although Otis Redding was actually on Volt. But
weren't Sam and Dave also on Stax at that point?
Sam and Dave were indeed on Stax, and an interesting thing that many people don't realize, they were never signed to Stax. They were signed to Atlantic Records and on loan
right.
from Atlantic Records. And when the deal ended with Stax, Atlantic took them back, and that was literally the end of their career.
Mm-hmm.
They never got back what they had at Stax. But that original powder blue label, and for some very odd reason, which I have yet to understand why it was used or when it was first used, there was a green label that was not dissimilar to the Decca label, but instead of saying Stax along the color, the white colored strip going through the label, it was just saying Stax in color that way with the colors stacked up on it.
Okay.
Very odd label. Very few records came out on that label, but it's still a cool permutation. Then, of course, when they became their own entity and they were gutted, for all intents and purposes, the finger snap.
Right, with the yellow label and the snapping fingers, yeah.
Right. And there's two versions of that. There's the original one, which was, you know, it was a yellow label and the fingers were white. In the early 70s, very subtly, they became a little browner.
Okay.
Is it? I have to say that, you know, even though 90% of my favorite records that came out on Stax were on the blue label, my immediate thought is forever going to be the finger snap.
Yeah.
That's you know, I'm going to get that tattooed on me somewhere sooner or later. You know, Stax and, of course, Atlantic, you know, you had – you mentioned Led Zeppelin, you know, Buffalo Springfield and Cream were all, and the Bee Gees were all on ATCO, which is equally, I forgive the use of this overthrown word, iconic, with the yellow label with the lute and the trumpet.
Right.
You know. But that's still part of the Atlantic Recording Corporation. You had Zeppelin. You had Bette Midler. You had the Coasters. You had the Drifters, you had Benny King, you had the Modern Jazz Quartet, you had John Coltrane, you had Thelonious Monk, you know, you had all the jazz greats for a start, you know, because Atlantic in the 50s was rhythm and blues and soul. You had Ray Charles, okay? You had, like I said, you had Bette Midler, you had ABBA, you had the sub-labels that had people like Stevie Nicks doing their solo careers. You know, she was on a sub-label called Mirage.
Right.
No, I'm sorry. She was on Modern Recordings. That was Jimmy Iovine's previous label. You had Cotillion. Oh, by the way, you had Yes, and you had Emerson, Lake & Palmer, who got their own label, you know, or was put onto their own label. The first they were on Cotillion, which was the Prog label or Proggy label. But then they started their own, Manticore. The Velvet Underground actually was on Atlantic for one label, one album, on Cotillion also for Loaded. But then you had, of course, later on you had Stone Temple Pilots and Hootie and the Blowfish, and you know, the era that I worked at Atlantic. And Atlantic, to me, the Atlantic, well, it's very simple. The Atlantic singles label was always going to be the red and the black, with the red bottom with the type, and that big, funny, old-fashioned kind of A.
That's the one that, right, that's the one that Immigrant Song and Hey, Hey, What Can I Do
is on. That's the 45s label. And the album label was red on top, Atlantic logo, colored with green and red, and then the green, oh, sorry, green on top, and then the red bottom with the white stripe, which said one or two when you turn the album over, and the red you could read the typo. Atlantic was, you know, it's the most recognizable label, you know, in the world. Can I say Capitol Records? Sure. But then there were the moments that, you know, me being the label geek and psycho that I am, because it's this kind of very sick and unhealthy label. I'm a label savant.
Mm-hmm.
It is. I started throwing out names aside from IRS, and I'll get to them in a second, like Dalton. Dalton, which I actually wrote a column about that got published in Rebeat. Dalton Records is most famous for being the home of the Ventures from Walk Don't Run until
– Sure.
Till they released Hawaii 5-0, you know. And Dalton was the Seattle-based offshoot of – or subsidiary, I should say, of Liberty Records. It was originally called Dolphin, hence the reason for the fish on the label.
Okay.
And that went through a few permutations, but the one that I remembered was the – it was this really nice kind of a – almost like a royal blue, and it had a really cool multicolored spelling of Dalton and a little box with the fish underneath it. That was the coolest of the labels that they had done. But then there are labels that, you know, when I hear a song, I think of that particular label like you did. You know, whenever I hear I Remember You by Frank Ifield, I think of the VJ Records label, not because Introducing the Beatles was on there, but because of that song. Or – Double Shot Records, which was the label that the Count Five were on, whenever I hear Psychotic Reaction. Or SGC, which if I hear Open My Eyes by the Nas, they were on. Yeah. That was an offshoot of Atlantic, actually. It was the sister label, actually, of Cold Gems, the home of the Monkees. But SGC, which stood for Screen Gems Columbia Pictures, went through Atlantic, whereas Cold Gems went through RCA. So Apple Records, of course, you know, I mean, that's kind of a given.
Right.
IRS Records, you brought up REM, but IRS 001, Singles Going Steady by the Buzzcocks, a strictly American album, you know. But then you have a couple of other things like SP005, The Damned, the Black Album, SP009, The Stranglers. It was only released here, again, another American-only permutation called Stranglers 4, which was really the bastardization of their album The Raven. There seem to be a lot of deals done between IRS and United Artists Records.
Yeah, okay.
Over in England, which at that time was kind of at the tail end of its own life. Then you had things like Skafish, Wasmo Nariz, Henry Badowski and Good Missionaries, The Fall, The First Things by Sham 69, The First Things by Squeeze. These were all IRS illegal. And one of the illegal, the first singles on Illegal was a song called Fallout Back with Nothing Achieving by a band called The Police. You know, IRS loomed really, really large and was vitally important, you know. And I'm not talking about the famous label that you and I both, and I think everybody knows, the one with the IRS guy, the guy in the hat and the glasses.
Right, right.
The silver label and the maroon writing. The original International Records Syndicate was a kind of rainbow color around a cream-colored center. You know, it was just an International Record Syndicate release is how it was always written out. It's a very weird squiggle, you know. Those were the original IRS labels. Stiff Records, you know, which had different versions of the label. If it ain't stiff, it ain't worth a fuck. Yep. Stiff says, you kill time, you murder success. Fuck art, let's dance, you know. The world's most flexible label. That was Stiff.
Well, yeah, and there were a couple of other ones. I mean, you talked about the blue, that kind of powder blue Stax label. There was another label previous to that back in the late 50s that also used that color. Good old Delphi.
Home of Richie Valens.
Yeah, home of Richie Valens and a couple of others. But there was also, Bayou Records had Clifton Chania and several other really top sort of early Zydeco acts that appeared on there. And I believe Gatemouth Brown may have been with them for a little while as well. And there was one other one, and I was, oh, yeah. Remind me, there's a label that is basically an oldies label now, and it's all black. And on the top of it, there's a kind of a graded picture, almost like a cartoon drawing of a 56 Buick. You know what I'm talking about?
56 Buick, an oldies label.
Yeah, it's just, it's a black label, and it's got this old car that kind of fades out as it goes down.
That almost sounds like the old United Artists Liberty oldies series.
It might be. It could very well be. It's one that I see all the time.
It was originally started as part of Liberty, and then when Liberty was unfortunately closed up and faded into United Artists as a whole, and all the Liberty sublabels like Imperial and Dalton, and even very briefly Blue Note, World Pacific and Pacific Jazz. Those were the another two. I think it was called the Silver Collector series.
Got it.
And it was an old car on a black label.
And right.
A very small UA logo down towards like the center point of it, and then you had the writing on it. I think I had a couple of Chipmunks things on that.
Okay.
Because my original Liberty singles were all scratched up and screwed up, so the only way you could get them was, you know. If you were a fan of music, there are labels that you're also Kiss, for God's sakes. All the permutations of the Casablanca label. You know, when you think of Kiss at their best, when you think of them, you know, from the first album, Dressed to Kill, Destroyer, you think of the original Blue label, you know, where it's just like this big white section where the band's name was and the name of the album, and it had the Bogart figure on the left, and it was just the trees and the neon lighting where it says Casablanca, and it was this really rich blue at the bottom. But 50s and 60s labels, you're talking about like King Records, that old navy blue label with the silver type, because that was the home of James Brown. We just very briefly mentioned Blue Note, you know. Prestige Records was another really cool label, which actually had, very briefly, Manfred Mann.
Oh, yeah.
Rock and roll. They released the first American Manfred Mann single, which happened to have been the major hit, 5-4-3-2-1. It went nowhere here, because what was a jazz label from New Jersey going to do with a rock and roll band from England? So then they got moved over to a subsidiary of United Artists called Ascot for the next single, which was Do I Diddy Diddy. Well, we know what happened with that one, because that became the hit in the United States. I mean, 5-4-3-2-1 was not only a hit, it was the theme to the show Ready, Steady, Go. But they were in England on EMI, and they never even released the first single here. Cock a Hoop was the very first thing that they ever put out. But, you know, those labels, we could be here all day on labels. For
right, and you hit it, by the way. It was United Artists. It was their Silver Spotlight series that had the car on it.
Remember what the other, but it was a cool looking label.
Yeah,
I mean, they were really chintzy ones, like Bell Records, and then later Arista with Flashback Records, or ABC, who of course later became absorbed into MCA, Oldies 45. Ugh, it was, talk about uninspired.
Mm-hmm.
At least when Capitol did an oldies thing, instead of the orange and yellow swirls, they had like a dark green, pale green swirl. You know,
yeah,
those are hard to find, really hard to find. So labels, we'll do another spot on labels, but I'm just so glad that you brought that up. You know, people talking about Sire Records and this one and that one. But I mean, Jesus, you know, I could pull out, you say the word Jet Records and people go, oh, wasn't Ozzy Osbourne on Jet? Never mind that. It was ELO's record label. That's right. What I think of.
Right.
You know?
And not to mention, I mean, you know, in terms of the style and the look of it, Motown had one of the best ones ever. Not to mention having a great catalog.
And Tamla. Their labels. It's funny because you know that the Motown label itself didn't come into existence until about 1965.
No shit.
It was all part of Motown Record Company, but it was on Tamla, Gordy, Soul, you know, all the little offshoots. Motown itself did not happen until the Supremes happened.
Yeah, there you go. And of course, you know, you had Sun predating them, so another great label. Gotta love your chicken.
And since you said, no, that's a cock, son. That's a cock. that's a Southern cock. And of course, there's the Ardent label. You know, that's personal. That's very close to my heart. But yeah, I mean, labels were fun. I mean, all somebody has to do is say Wooden Nickel, and I just start laughing because that was the original home of the shittiest band of all time, Styx.
Yeah.
So there you go.
Fun stuff.
Label me any day, baby. Label any day.
And we have a couple of new artists. Well, not new artists necessarily, but some new music to talk over as well. And one that you laid on me, and I'm oh so glad you did. And I'm also glad that in your column on Popdos, you name-checked Flock of Seagulls, because the very first thing that I thought of when I heard the new release from Death of Lovers was, wow, these guys were really big fans of Flock of Seagulls.
These kids are definite students of the 80s, and I mean serious students, because they hit all the right notes, no pun intended, on how to produce something that came right out of 1981, 82.
Yep.
I swear to you, when I heard this record for the first time, I listened to it all the way through because I thought it was that good. Rather than starting to write anything, I actually went track for track, and I thought to myself, it's simple, I've got it already. But the thing is, they move from band to band. They keep the consistency. So it sounds like you're listening to WLIR radio circa 82, early 83, you know, or yep. 81, 82, 83. You know, they've got that Flock of Seagulls sound with the nice delay on the guitars. They have that Joy Division feel, but not dirgy.
Right. Right. No, it's fun. It's fun and it's interesting. It's got a very cool kind of groove to it.
They've also definitely got the Cure thing down. Circa, Faith. Well, you know, the latter half of 17 Seconds and Faith, the more, I'm going to use the word upbeat and, you know, faster. I know that's an oxymoron with the Cure, but like the singles, for argument's sake, A Forest or Primary.
Yeah.
You know, ones that moved, that had motor to it, but also it sounded an awful lot like they had been listening to some of my favorites, like The Chameleons or The Sound or The ComSat Angels. You know, they really took notes. And I find that to be extremely warming because at least they took the care to put the details in, you know, and to get those details right. Feed them all. They have a sense of knowing how to write a song. So even if for argument's sake they hadn't done it in this particular vein and didn't sound so 80s, the songs are still there.
You know, the one thing, though, that I'm glad they didn't fall into is that there was a trap that erupted with a lot of that 80s music, and it pegged it to the decade, which was it would go along, the song would hit a groove, and then as soon as it got to the chorus, it would brighten up. All of a sudden, everything is clangy, everything is clashy, and it's very bright. And then it just has to kind of downbeat itself back into the verses. And they didn't go that direction. It's the one thing that's un-80s about it, and I like it. I like the way it sounds a lot better. And it's a little smoother, and I think it'll give it a little bit more shelf life.
They're definitely a band with a lot of consistency on this record.
Yes.
And that's a really, really good sign.
Right.
Because this is, you know, this is their first album. You know, they had an EP out in 2014, but this is something else because this gives you a bigger scope on what they can do.
Right. Yeah, it's so, very cool stuff. So I'm glad that you laid that one on us. And the other one is a band called the Rockin' Bricks, and this again is going to involve a little bit of a history lesson, but in a different way. Who are the Rockin' Bricks?
The Rockin' Bricks were a band from New Brunswick, New Jersey, and they came out of the same scene that I did. You know, all of these wonderful local bands of the early 80s, you know, Two Minutes Hate came out of Staten Island in 1983, but we were all in the same physical area and we all played the same clubs, whether it was the Dirt Club in Bloomfield or the Jetty or the Court Tavern or, you know, some of the other places that I played, certainly RT Fireflies or Snafus or Tracks or the Dive, you know. There were certain bands that all sprang up around that time. There was the Tapes, which are still in a way going with a completely different lineup after all these years. Mm-hmm. And it goes under the name of Bill Pop and the Tapes since he was the founder of the group. But still, the first gig 2 Minutes Hate ever did was with the Tapes, actually, at RT Fireflies. But the point is, the Rockin' Bricks came from that whole same scene. So did the Smithereens. You know, that's how tiny our little universe was.
Yeah.
But the Rockin' Bricks, of course, did not last long enough, really, to merit a, hey, you know, that band, remember them? They were really influential. They weren't around long enough to leave enough of a legacy, which is a crying shame, because the compilation that I reviewed, which is just called Complete Rockin' Bricks, is so good and so consistent. And the fact that, you know, like us, they paid out of pocket. This wasn't a signed band. The production quality is terrific. These fellas knew how to write songs. They were great writers. They were great singers. They were great constructors of the classic 3 to 4 minute pop song. Now, what I find most interesting is that one of the main songwriters and leaders of the band, Peter Tomlinson, is such an enormous Big Star fan, and I'm not going to say anything more than that, because then we're going to be getting into a whole other murky area.
Yeah, right.
And how do I know this? But I'll leave that for another time. But he's got such a terrific ear for pop. But also, one of the foils of his in the band is Chris Breitfeld, who's been in numerous bands that are fairly well known, respected, and so on and so forth. The long and short of it is that the Bricks were a great band. This is a fantastic compilation. This is something that when you're hungry, this will satisfy your appetite and then some. It's like saying, you know what, I'm really in the mood for a nice submarine sandwich, but one's not enough.
Yeah.
So you go through two or three. That's this kind of album, you know. You will chomp your way through these songs and you will love them. You know, this was a band that – They had the Beatles influence, very certainly. They had a Cheap Trick feel. But then there were songs in there that just outright sound like the Stranglers to me. Funny, that's twice we've name checked them tonight.
Yeah, that's right.
And there's a song especially called Foreign Girl that I swear to you, if you didn't know it, you might think on first listen, is this a DB song? You know, that's how good and how much width this band had.
How much trouble do you have to go through to get a hold of this thing?
Not much. All you need to do is go to Bandcamp. Well, first just type in, rockinbricks.bandcamp.com and you'll hear it.
And it's Complete, spelled the way the Complete Beatles is spelled, with E-A-T at the end. So,
correct. And those guys were clever enough to do that, because only those of us old enough to have watched the Complete Beatles would know this.
Exactly, so, yeah. So, yeah. Got to get a hold of that.
And I wanted to say that they just recently got back together again and had a reunion show. Now, there's a question of whether or not they would even think to do it again, but I am of the very cautious hope. And I'll even throw down and say, listen, if you guys ever decide that you're going to get back together, I will fight tooth and nail to get the original Punchline lineup back together just so we can play on the same bill, because that would be great.
Good deal. All right. We'll be watching for the tickets to go on sale for that show sometime soon. And we've got a little bit of TV to get into as well, but there's a documentary, and this goes right to my lovely bride and one of her favorite bands of all time. She's a huge XTC fan and she's very happy this week. Why?
Well, and I don't want to spoil it for anybody, but last Sunday when you and I were doing the last show, it was my birthday, and Mr. Tomlinson, who we just mentioned of the Rockin' Bricks, was kind enough to actually send me the documentary before it even aired. It was like a little birthday gift. So just as you were about to, you know, call me, I'd finished watching it.
Nice.
That's why it's so fresh in my mind. But I watched it on the big screen, you know, when it premiered on Thursday night on Showtime. XTC, This Is Pop, told in their own words, all four members of the band. I read the biography of X, the authorized biography of XTC, Chalk Hills and Children, back in 1993. So from the fans' point of view, this didn't really tell me anything new. It didn't tell me much. If anything, it left out a lot of the details and important factors that the book had in it. What I found not great was that there's an inconsistency, because it just seems to go from English settlement and blipping right over Mummer, which isn't even mentioned by name.
Mm-hmm.
The Big Express is mentioned in passing. They do give about 2.5 minutes, 3 minutes worth on the Dukes of Stratosphere. Skylarking gets its due because, of course, Dear God was the hit, but you never even hear Earn Enough for Us, which was the song that got me onto that album. It never even mentions Wasp Star, which was the very last album. It was technically Apple Venus Part 2. There's something about it that just felt very incomplete.
Okay.
That's how I felt about it. Now, we have to do another minor history lesson. It was in January of 1979. I was all of 14 and in eighth grade, one of those rare moments when I was able to stay up late on a Friday night. And there was a TV show called Twiggy's Jukebox, in which she would show promo clips of bands from England. It was on Channel 11 here. And she did this really goofy thing about, you know, and this next band is called Ecstasy. Ecstasy. XTC. And I hadn't heard of them before, and it was the videos for Life Begins at the Hop and Making Plans for Nigel.
Okay.
And from that moment forward, you want to talk about being completely knocked off your feet? I was just so agog by it that I think it was the Sunday I made my parents take me to the nearest Corvettes to see if they actually had anything by XTC. And lo and behold, they had three albums. They had the brand new album, Drums and Wires, which had on it Making Plans for Nigel and Life, and opened up with Life Begins at the Hop, which was on Virgin Records, distributed by Atlantic.
Oh, okay. Very good.
And, which was a white label with the red type. And then there were two other albums, but it was a different lineup because there was a keyboard player in it. There was an album called White Music, which you didn't know was called White Music unless you had opened up the record and saw it on the label, or you read the spine, and an album called Go To. So I got all of them because those two albums were $3.99. They were also on Virgin. They were in the import department, but they weren't imports. They were distributed through Gem. They were on a label that was known as Virgin International.
Okay.
And it was a tan label, and Go To had a fold-out in it, which it was a picture of the band, but then if you held it a certain way, it continued where the type on the album cover broke. So you could read the rest of the notes while you're holding this thing up. So suffice it to say that in one fell swoop, I became very dedicated to XTC because those three albums were indeed life-changing. Now, Drums and Wires was just magnificent. It had Life Begins at the Hop. It had Making Plans for Nigel, but it also had 10 Feet Tall. It had When You're Near Me, I Have Difficulty. It had one of my top XTC songs of all time, Reel by Reel. But the absolute weirdness, herky-jerky, quirky, jagged, angular, bizarro futuristicness of White Music and Go To can never be understated. Opening up with Radios in Motion, which is one of the two XTC songs that not the punchline, but 2 Minutes Hate used to do. And, you know, into equal weirdness with Colin Moulding sounding like Andy Partridge on Set Myself on Fire. But this album also had This Is Pop, Statue of Liberty, Heading into the Atom Age, Go To had J-U-M-P-I-N-G, Jumping in Gomorrah, I'm Religion Free, Mechanic Dancing, Oh We Go, The Rhythm, Battery Brides. But there were two songs in particular One is not even mentioned on the album cover, and it happened to have been, I think, placed there by the American Virgin label because it was the single in England at the moment called Are You Receiving Me?
Okay, yeah.
An absolute obvious masterstroke and moment of sheer genius by Andy Partridge and Colin Moulding's equally brilliant Crowded Room, right? So those three albums turned me into an absolute maniac. Now, getting into high school, like the first week we had to go to gym class, I hated everybody already. I kept to myself. We're in gym class, and you know, you have to change your clothes. You got your T-shirt on underneath it. This kid had a yellow Drums and Wires T-shirt on, and I said to him something, you know, something along the lines of, "Oh my God, you like XTC?" And you know who they are? Oh, huge fan, you know. And he became my best friend in high school, my friend Rick. And this is now September 79. In April of 81, they were on tour. They were here. They were playing the Palladium, which is no longer there, of course.
Yeah.
Saturday night, April 15th, 1981, opening bands, brand new group Joan Jett and the Blackhearts featuring Eric Roscoe Amble as guitarist. Big thumbs up, in which the incredibly lovely Ms. Jett was handing out albums herself along with the band out in the front of the Palladium for free.
Wow.
And if you had that copy, it's not even called Bad Reputation. It's just called Joan Jett and the Blackhearts.
Okay.
It was on their own label too, Blackheart Records. This was before Boardwalk ever picked them up. But the first band on the bill was Jules Holland and his Millionaires.
Oh, wow.
Featuring Pino Palladino on bass, right? Because he actually had a minor hit single on IRS of Bumble Boogie.
Okay, yeah.
And they all three, those two bands were fantastic, you know, no question about it. But XTC came out, and I will tell you that if I thought those first three records were something, there was a snowstorm. I was shoveling snow outside. I had a little radio with me. I was listening to some FM station, and I heard Generals and Majors for the first time. It may have been WPIX-FM because that was the new wave station at the time in New York. It was very brief, but it was an actual punk and new wave station.
Okay.
And they played Generals and Majors, and I flipped out. You know, so Black Sea to me was an even bigger revelation than Drums and Wires and the first two had been, because Black Sea has on it, opening with the magnificent, Respectable Street, Generals and Majors, Living Through Another Cuba, Love at First Sight, Turn It Over, the first song on side two, is probably, people may want to argue it, and I'm happy to argue it with them, Andy Partridge's finest moment as a songwriter, Towers of London.
Yeah.
Paper and Iron, Notes and Coins, Burning with Optimism's Flames, Sergeant Rock is Going to Help Me.
Which is another great tune.
I mean, that was Black Sea. This band could do no wrong. And so seeing them, they opened up with Real by Real. And Andy Partridge is such a fantastic frontman. You know, it was, you know, they had like a little cartoon thing in the background, like during Living Through Another Cuba, which it certainly assured me that Terry Chambers is one of the greatest drummers in music, period, because nobody could play like that. And he did it live, you know?
Yep.
And you know, like the words Cuba, you know, C-U-B, every time he hit Living Through Another Cuba, you'd see little bombs dropping on C-U-B-A, you know? Because, you know, it said those lyrics of, you know, we're the bulldog on the fence while the others play their tennis overhead, you know? They were incredible. XTC were incredible. And without even hearing it, we were in, just before they went out of business, Bonaparte's, the British record store, and they, of course, had the brand new import albums, and they had the brand new double album from XTC called English Settlement. It was a snowy Saturday. Sight Unseen bought it, figured it's going to be good. I think you and I talked about this years ago on Overnight America, because I wrote an article, because I was doing a series that I will occasionally do about perfect albums. And that was the first album that I had written about in that vein. English Settlement is a perfect album.
Right.
Original double LP, there are no flaws. So, you know, I have a very emotional attachment to XTC still. And I'm happy that people are finally getting it. albeit late. But the documentary itself just kind of left me feeling a little flat. That's all. But I also understand it because Andy Partridge himself says, I hate documentaries, rockumentaries, rock documentaries. You watched it. You saw it. You know.
Yeah.
He says that very – the funniest thing about it is him saying that. And then they always have the lugubrious keyboard player from some 70s prog rock band and Rick Wakeman saying, oh, yes, I remember XTC. Don't you dare have him in this.
Right, right. Well – yeah, and you know, at least it shows a little bit of a sense of humor, but it is disappointing when you have the opportunity to really open some doors and then they don't.
Yeah, I mean, XTC has been so rich with stories, you know, some of the more serious, and I'm not being funny when I say this, some of the serious struggles that they had to deal with, like David Gregory, who is one of the most phenomenal musicians and obviously a very lovely human being. That man has suffered with the most severe form of diabetes since he was a kid. So traveling on the road was always a nightmare for him. Never mind Andy Partridge's problem by being, you know, hooked on Valium, you know, or the emotional upheavals that Colin Moulding suffered with. You know, it's just – there's a lot of story there. There really is. The other thing is they should have brought up the fact that Andy Partridge has had himself a very nice little successful – brief side career doing comedy on radio and hosting a children's TV show over there, because there was this famous thing. It was like a Dear Abby column.
Yeah.
It was a radio show called Agony Aunt. So he did a spoof of it called Agony Andy, which was phenomenally successful because obviously he's a character in and of himself. I mean, he's hilarious.
Right.
He's insane, but he's hilarious. And he also did hosting a kid's TV show. You know?
Yep. So missed opportunity there. Now, on the television front, we've got a couple of things to go over, not the least of which is the fact that we have now seen over the last 7 days three or four of the most incredible football games I can remember ever.
True.
With the national championship game, the college national championship game, where you had an impossible comeback. And it was led by a kid who nobody knew at the beginning of the game.
Right. Now, I am a huge – because I didn't go to a real college. You know, Pace University had maybe fencing. You know, I don't think we had anything else at the time. You know, I root for the Georgia Bulldogs because it's the University of Georgia. It's Athens. I've been there. It's gorgeous. REM are from there. Pylon are from there. Blah, blah, blah.
Yep.
But, you know, that's my college football team. When it comes to college basketball, 9 times out of 10, I'll say Kentucky. But, yeah, every now and then I watch the Memphis Tigers because obviously my heart is in Memphis. But anyway, I really thought I really thought the Georgia Bulldogs were going to finally unseat the fucking Crimson Tide. I hate Nick Saban. Daniel Tosh hates Nick Saban.
Right.
And I like Daniel Tosh, although I don't agree with him on Arn Anderson, but that's another story entirely.
Yep.
This kid who quarterbacked Alabama was not even the starting quarterback. The starting quarterback who they raved about was pulled because he couldn't do anything.
Yeah.
And Georgia was winning this thing by 2 touchdowns after halftime. And then after halftime ended, somehow – no, it's not somehow. The Bulldogs let Alabama back in, and Alabama won their, what, 5th consecutive title?
Something like that. Yeah, it's ungodly. But yeah. But
from a football point of view, magnificent.
Right.
Magnificent game.
And that's part of the magic of it, really, with college football and with the NFL, is that – as we saw, I mean, with the comeback game that was led by Frank Reich back in 1993, that we just had the 25th anniversary of, and that hurts my heart. But that comeback game with the Bills against the then Houston Oilers, where they came from 32 points down and won the damn game. And, you know, you're never truly out of it until the 2-minute warning hits. I mean, you can come back, and occasionally something magic happens.
The thing is, for once, the teams seem to have really stepped it up, and I mean stepped it up in a way that I didn't even think possible.
Yeah,
because you're also dealing with and listening to all these idiots go on about, and once again, it's always pundits that have to say, "Well, so and so is going to give them a shellacking." Like, here's a perfect example today. The Pittsburgh Steelers were the heavy favorites,
right,
against the Jacksonville Jaguars. Yesterday, the Falcons were the heavy favorites against the Eagles. Well, that didn't turn out quite right on either front.
Right. Yeah, and I'm fine with that on both fronts because, you know, I have no great affinity for the Tennessee Titans, although I did live in Nashville for a little while. But, you know, as far as Jacksonville is concerned, just seeing them manhandle Pittsburgh's defense like they did and cut through them like a knife following last week's game where they were, I mean, it wasn't until the third quarter they were able to score a touchdown on the Bills. It was fun to watch. It was fun to see that game go back and forth the way that it did. And for them to put up between them 80 something points. I love games like that. I love shootouts. But
I actually have a question about that Jacksonville game. Was Bortles able to actually throw this week?
Well, you know,
last week, because obviously
sometimes.
Okay.
There, you know, it was like last week's game in the fact that, you know, he could look awful. He could miss open throws. There was one that was about a 10-yard out, and he was on a waggle, so he was staring right at the receiver 10 yards down the field and whipped the ball at him at about 100 miles an hour. Now, it was on target, but it went right through his hands because he threw it too hard, and it was just a dumb thing. But there were a couple of throws that he made that were great. What really made the difference again this week was his feet. They could not see him about to run, and as soon as that's the case, he's going to burn you, and he did.
Good for him. Good for them. Because I can't stand the Steelers because I hate Ben Roethlisberger. Hey, now, here you go. Not to get off topic, but Roethlisberger's got a track record. It's called rape.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Where's the Me Too movement? And the other game, and this one actually will lead us into the In Our Head segment this week, is that game where the Minnesota Vikings gained the lead, gave up the lead, and then retook the lead within the last 2 minutes of the game. It was incredible to watch.
In the last minute of the game.
Right. I mean, to see them do what they did, and up by a point, they were up 22-21, and they were up 21-19, and they let New Orleans kick the field goal, go up 22-21, and then with less than 40 seconds on the clock and one timeout, they were able to mount a winning touchdown drive. And it was fantastic to see on their own home turf them able to do it. And, I mean, how that pass got through, how the receiver was able to – I mean, the safety blew the play. And that's he was afraid of getting a pass interference penalty because he got there a little too early. But the thing is, at that point, you take the pass interference penalty because the alternative is what happened. He walks into the end zone and the game's over.
The fact that he stumbled and I thought he was going to go down on a knee but didn't.
Yeah.
He spun and then suddenly started to run. No, he didn't even realize, I don't think at first, because he looked behind him, didn't realize there was nobody there.
There was nobody else there, yeah. Right. Yeah.
I thought the reaction on the side was amazing too, because the quarterback was, you know, like, his mouth dropped open and his eyes went wide, and that's when he realized they had won the game.
Right.
There's that nice little side story about this woman who's 100 years old in the stands watching the game, and she supported the Vikings since they came into the league.
Right.
And this is all she wanted to see, you know? And they won the fucking game.
Right. And not only did they win it, they won it in grand fashion like that. And then there was the hilarious bit about them having to go out and snap the ball again. So all of a sudden, everybody's on the field. The reporters are on the field. The players are on the field. The New Orleans Saints were in the locker room. And the official came out and said, We have to kick the point. And they didn't even do that. They just snapped the ball and, you know, and took a knee and got out of there because the point was meaningless anyway. You know, nothing could have happened that would have changed the outcome of the game. Yeah, they just took a knee on the last play.
I'm not having any of this. No more knee taking in football. a lot of bad hombres taking knees in football. I'm not happy. That's un-American.
But it was one of those things. So they ended up winning the game 29-22, and it was just so much fun.
It was exciting as exciting could possibly be.
Yeah.
And I don't even have the great thing is that we don't even have a vested interest in this game because your guys are the Bills. Mine are the my season ended with the Jets back in December.
Right.
November. It's just the simple fact that this is what makes the games fun. And on the flip side, you know, I just took a quick glimpse and the Rangers really shit the bed again tonight. 5-2 loss to the Penguins. You're not going to tell me that they're not trying to get their coach fired with the lousy way that they've lost three in a row now all week. And in these last two games, they've given up 12 goals, okay, between yesterday and today. 12-4, they've been outscored. That's mortifying.
Right.
They're going to fire. Well, they're going into the, what do you call it, next week, the All-Star break. So maybe they'll fire Vigneault then.
Well, I've actually got two in our heads things to get to this week, and we'll be able to spin them both because the first one that occurred to me occurred because of the guy, Marcus Williams is his name, the safety who got burned on that last play that knocked his New Orleans Saints out of the playoffs. And I was in a conversation with somebody online, and we were watching the game. And after we got done with about 5 minutes of, holy shit, what an amazing end that was to that game, and talking about all the things that happened, he made a comment. He said, you know, that kid who, the safety for the Saints who blew that play, he's going to have to charter his own flight home. And I thought, nah, he's probably going to have to walk. And that's when it hit me. I was like, that's the perfect song for this guy to listen to on the flight home is Fats Domino's Walking to New Orleans. Because that's really what he ought to be doing.
This time I'm walking to New Orleans. I'm walking to New Orleans. I'm going to need to parachute when I get through walking these blues. When I get back to New Orleans.
What it kicked off in my head again was I started going down the list of all of these great songs that have the name of a city in them. And walking to New Orleans, I mean, as goofy as it is, you know, the connection back to the football game, it is such a great piece of music. And that, again, was back in a time when you could say so much in 2 minutes. I think that song runs 2:28, something along those lines. It's a very short tune, and yet it's indelible. It's just fantastic. And, you know, between that and, I mean, every – how many songs about Boston are there? How many songs about New York are there? How many songs about Chicago are there?
All I have to do is this. Please come to Boston.
There you go. Please come to Boston for the springtime. Great song.
As you say, hey, rambling boy, now won't you settle down? Boston ain't your kind of town. There ain't no gold. I'm the number one fan of the man from Tennessee.
So I'm going to hand it off to you. I've got a couple of my own sort of favorites that either mention a city prominently, like Dirty Water, another one that mentions Boston over and over again, but specifically the ones that have the names of a city in their title.
Memphis, Tennessee by Chuck Berry.
Yeah.
But the version I actually like the most, and I'm not sure if many people know it because it's on a fairly obscure album, Elvis Presley, his 1965 album Elvis for Everyone, he did a fantastic version of that song.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's stay in Memphis and give the Stray Cats a little love for 18 Miles from Memphis, another killer song.
Galveston.
Yeah.
And actually, REM did a, I don't know if it was a spoof or a tribute, because they name check Galveston in the song.
Mm-hmm.
Song called Houston.
Okay.
I Love L.A.
Oh, Randy Newman, yeah.
I don't love L.A., but, you know, I'm just bringing up Randy Newman for the sake of it.
Dig the song, though.
Let's see, what else is there?
How about Wichita Lineman?
Fuck you. Fuck! There's the old Johnny Thunders and the Heartbreaker song, London Boy.
Yeah.
Oh man,
London, yeah, London's another one's got 100 of them. London Calling, yeah, sure.
London Girl by the Jam,
yep.
London's Burning by the Clash,
yeah, which I think is a better song, by the way.
Towers of London.
I'm trying to think that if there must be, because you know, that Virginia, North Carolina corridor, there's got to be songs about Charlotte and Richmond and, you know, places like that. I can't pull any of them out of my head at the moment, though. Yeah, Philadelphia Freedom. I mean, we can go back to the 70s for that one.
Sure, sure. I've been more than viable.
Yep.
San Francisco Nights by Eric Burdon and the Animals.
Animals.
Strobe lights beam, creates dreams. Walls move, minds do. On a warm San Francisco night. Old child, young child, feel all right. On a warm San Francisco night.
Yes, as you were getting there, I thought, yeah, okay. I was going up the coast of California going, there's got to be something there.
Yep. Does Springsteen actually have songs with towns in the title?
Yeah, probably. Well, and I was just thinking of Cleveland Rocks. That one's got to be in there as well. Well, of course, he did that Nebraska album, so.
What about Chicago? The Night Chicago Died.
The Night Chicago Died, Paper Lace, yep.
Okay. I'm sure there's some really cruelly obvious ones, you know?
Yeah, but that's what the comment section is for.
All right, I'm thinking all of a sudden Neil Diamond, Brooklyn Roads.
Yeah. Well, there's a song called Tallahassee Lassie.
Freddie Boom Boom Cannon.
That's right.
The jerk who wrote Palisades Park.
They're right. And there's a guy by the name of Johnny Lutz Ritter, who I think is related to Tex Ritter. I'm not sure. But he wrote a song about my wife's hometown called Beautiful Downtown Lutz. And it's about a little burg just north of Tampa called Lutz, Florida. It's L-U-T-Z, so it looks like Lutz, but it's pronounced Lutz.
Also, 26, this one's there are two that are staring right at us.
Uh-huh.
It's right in the face. Don't Go Back to Rockville.
Oh, of course. Right.
And Texarkana off of Out of Time.
And the town that I'm the closest to, or the big city that I'm closest to, St. Louis, has given us a number, including, well, there's the St. Louis Blues, of course. And there was one, Chuck Berry had a song that mentioned St. Louis in the title. So,
Kansas City by Wilbert Harrison.
Right. Kansas City, here I come.
Come on, what's got Detroit in the title?
Detroit. Something. Rock City.
Fuck. New York Groove.
New York Groove. Oh, we got to end, yeah, with Ace Frehley. So that's the first in our heads thing.
Really?
And again, you know, if you're going to put something in the comment section, by all means, if you've got some more great city songs, drop them in and we'd love to see them. The other one, and this was actually another song that popped into my head this week for the first time in a long time, and it has always been one of my favorite songs in general, but certainly one of my favorites by one of my favorite writers. And I don't know what kicked it off, but I was on my way to work and it was so in my head that I had to stop and find the thing on YouTube, because even the Amazon Prime Music didn't help me out with it. Never Been to Spain. And the Three Dog Night version of that song is the way that it builds. We've talked about this before. I love a song that's got a great build to it. And it starts out so slow, and by the time it gets to the end, it's rocking so hard that I just love it.
Can you feel it? Must be real it. Feel so good. Oh, feel so good. Well, I never been to heaven, but I've been to Oklahoma. Well, they tell me I was born there, but I really don't remember.
thing about that song is it's one of at least two, if not three, hits that Three Dog Night had that were written by Hoyt Axton. And Hoyt is, I mean, is so completely underrated and overlooked as a songwriter. He got his due, and I mean, he had a good acting career. He had a good singing career. It's not that nobody likes Hoyt. I think everybody likes Hoyt Axton. I mean, he was the dad in Gremlins, for fuck's sake. So, but you know, he wrote so much. He wrote for Steppenwolf. He wrote for Three Dog Night. He wrote for all of these great bands. And I think he's a guy that people should be able to list off seven or eight titles that he didn't even perform, you know, of hit songs that he wrote. So as we bring this one toward its eventual close, what are some of the Hoyt Axton cuts, whether or not he performed them and made them famous, that are pieces of music that always lived with you?
Well, the No-No song was the one.
A woman that I know just came from Mallorca, Spain. She smiled because I did not understand. Then she held out a 10-pound bag of cocaine. She said it was the finest in the land. And I said, no, 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 I don't, no more. I'm tired of waking up on the floor. No, thank you, please, it only makes me sneeze. Then it makes it hard to find the door.
Never Been to Spain is another one because my mother was a big fan of Three Dog Night.
Okay.
But, of course, I really... Which one did he write? Did he write Joy to the World?
Yes.
Yeah, I hate that fucking song. I really, really hate that song a lot. And I hate it a lot, you know? Because we were forced to do it in assemblies.
Oh, okay, yeah.
But of the other songs that I kind of liked, weirdly enough, I actually like Greenback Dollar because he wrote that.
Yeah, it's a great tune.
I mean, that's one of those that's an American classic, you know?
Right.
That is a hardcore American classic. So that's, you know.
He also had a knack with novelty songs. I mean, for that matter, Joy to the World is kind of a novelty song. Yeah. Jeremiah was a bullfrog. Yeah. But Bony Fingers was also his. Work your fingers to the bone and what do you get? Bony Fingers. That's Hoyt Axton. But the one that I think was the most, in its finished version, was the most un-Hoyt-like song. Because it's clear with the No-No song and several others that he had...
If you say the Pusher, I'm going to slap you.
Not the Pusher, but you're close, because that song adds into it as well. There were a lot of songs about drugs, and, you know, he could be funny about it, but he could also be very introspective about it. And he also wrote a song that was performed by Steppenwolf called Snowblind Friend that's about coke addiction. And that's a great tune.
The guy could write a song like nobody's business.
Yeah.
But it's just funny because, you know, No-No song is just so goofy.
Right.
That's just plain goofy. And, you know, you give it to Ringo and it works, you know?
Yep.
Especially with the no, 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 I don't. No more. That's classic.
Yeah. So a little tribute to Hoyt Axton just because Never Been to Spain came upon me again. So, again, if you've got more to put it in the comment section. We would love to hear from you. Do that thing. And Rob Ross, I think that's about going to do it for you and me this week, my man. And I hope you enjoy the next round of the playoffs. And we'll be talking about it here in addition to a bunch of other pop culture stuff next time around.
We will. We should be. We've got much more to talk about, things that are up on Pop Dose now and will be up on Pop Dose. You know, upcoming shows, more sports. We won't talk about hockey. And, of course, we always have our ever-loving president.
Oh, yeah.
It's plenty of entertainment and editorial commentary. So, in any event, have a great week. Take care of yourself. Stay warm.
See you then.
I'll see you later.